So, Digit Lifestyles Day, January 26, 2006, Munich, Germany. Felix Pedersen from Places.com, Robbie Stans from IDEO, Brad Rubenstein from BlogCarnival.com, and I'm Andreas Weigand, Weigand Associates. We were discussing about what the web has been in Web 1.0, which was basically a read-only web. Big companies and some academics putting in links that determine where people can go, and they determine the geography of the web. Web 2.0, with its architecture of participation, becoming a read-write web. You could write to companies like Delicious, or of course blogs, podcasts, being examples of lots of people contributing. And we described Web 2.0 as a bunch of dots, millions and millions of dots, but basically bots, dots that are only very, very rarely connected. What's next was the question, and I proposed, well, first of all, after two comes three. So Web 3.0 will be the next, and Web 3.0 will focus on the connections between the dots. So if you will, Web 3.0 is connecting the dots. So what we'll need then is architectures of interaction and not architectures of participation. How can we design incentives for people to interact? How can we design ways such people take part and interact with each other? That was the topic which we started to discuss.
I would assume in order to figure out which interactions are useful for me, I need to have some parameters of, say, context. So there probably will have to be another layer above the content layer, which is the context layer, that needs to be another network to figure out what the where the relevant pieces for me are in this.
It has been said that OpenBC actually is a Web 3.0 company, and Sarek Weber, the chief sales officer of OpenBC, just joined us. How do you deal with that?
Hello, Andreas. I think interactive behavior becomes more and more important. Actually, we see that one of the most popular features is when people check who looked at their site, and this shows that people they want to experience something which is close to real life. They look at the photos of the other people visiting their page, and then they really decide to interact with that person.
Now, an important element for humans for interaction is locality. And the strength of the web, the disappearance of space and time, can be problematic for interactions, because interactions do take place in space-time. Felix, did you found Places.com?
Yes, I did.
As founder of Places.com, did you think about Places as a potential enabler for interactions between individuals?
Yes, definitely. I mean, what we were seeing in the last couple of years was the advent of what's called social software. And a lot of that software is explicit. So I construct an identity. It might be my real identity, but it's a constructed identity. So on Friendster or on other services, I explicitly say I'm into Harley Davidson, I'm into Peter Gabriel, and it will never match what I actually do. And what we will see is implicit social software, where you just leave traces and it really merges with your real life. There is no fake identity or second identity, because you produce and leave traces all day. So in order to have a second identity, you need a second life.
Yes and no. There are some issues which you should postpone for later, of pseudonyms versus true identity, because sometimes if you allow people to have several pseudonyms, it actually can make it much easier to discover the current situation, state, and volitions therein. But I want to go back to the point which you just said, that of implicit and also explicit naming of their locations. Because that by itself does not constitute interaction. These are still dots, and these dots become richer. Richer and richer, because having the geographic traces about them. So are your thoughts actually how you can connect the dots?
Well, I mean, the people already talk. And the internet always was about communication. And what services like Places or OpenBC or other services do, they provide context in human communication. There's concepts like presence, where You know, I can decide whether I interact with you in an instant messenger based on whether you're available or not. And what, for example, Places does, it just enriches this context. It says, I'm not just available, I'm around the corner. And I'm in this and that social situation. The same is true for social networks. You know, who do you know that's, you know, decides on how interesting that person is to me? And so therefore, the dots are already connected. We're just enriching the connections.
Andreas, if I could just throw something in. The distinction between the dots and the connections sounds like it's blurring. And what's actually happening is as these dots get richer and richer, part of their richness is the adjacency of other dots, in to use the locality terms. And so the distinction may just be collapsing, that as information gets richer and richer, the connections are part of that richness.
So maybe to push the dots metaphor a bit further, we could have those dots develop little antennas or pinnacles which poke out like a snake has, and thus getting a little bit further. What do you think?
The connection of the dots is by several dimensions. There's the temporal dimension, of course. There's the local dimension, geographic dimension, which the web has resolved. I think there's still a distinguishing factor between the time dimension. Are the two people that want to connect or the group that wants to connect online, immediately live, interactive, or do they send a mail or a message and then any time later something comes back, which is a completely different type of interaction because all the social aspects are a lot more subdued. And the third point is the vicinity of the dots in terms of, say, topic or content, which then, of course, there's plenty of services for which would create basically a new globe of various topics where people sit next to each other because they are interested in all those topics. And I would love to see a map that maps basically all those in a new type of globe, I guess.
Andreas, I want to say something about discovery in the context of this, because you were talking about discovery before. What I'm realizing is that when you were talking about the richness of your context, that's a matter of discovery, right? Because what constitutes richness in a given context is something that has to be discovered. It's not something that's necessarily intrinsic. Location in some contexts is not an important characteristic, and in others it is. You had spoken earlier about the change in value of search versus discovery. Maybe you could say something more about how you were talking about what it means to discover something and what that means for creating these connections and how they get created and how you determine that they're valuable or salient even in a given context.
Search is about items you know of their existence. You can't for search something if you have never heard of it. Discovery, I would like to define as something which you don't know exactly what you're looking for, and you don't know exactly when you are done finding it. So, the question is now that if you have a search engine or a find engine, you have a pretty good feeling when it is that you found the result you're looking for. You want to know when is the train leaving from Hoboken to Philadelphia, look it up, timetable done. On the other hand, discovery has much more of the ingredients of addiction in them, because you don't know when you're done. You're discovering something and you don't know, maybe there's something way better to be discovered around the corner. So for getting to very rich user experiences and getting to create addictions as MMORPGs, massive multiplayer online role-playing games, as online trading, eBay Schwabs, E-Trades Schwabs, as online purchasing and auctions like eBay, those constant changing environments of potentially always finding something yet better. That, I think, Brad, is one of the elements here in discovery, which is different from search.
So maybe we can welcome Rick Yul Kim, who just joined us from Korea. We're talking about discovery and search. What would be your opinion? Will discovery be more and more important and replace search?
So actually, Rick just joined, and the question really is, we talked about discovery. And if you think about discovery, for instance, in SciWorld, how do people discover each other versus how do people use SciWorld for maintenance of just talking to their friends?
Well, on that point of maintenance, I think we talked about it over a couple of days. SciWorld is different from the other social networking community spaces in that people transplant their real-life relationships and their real-life knowledge onto the online space. And that's where we concentrate in making sure that the online experience is as close approximation of their real-life world or in space online. So in terms of taking that and sort of, you know, thinking about, so where is the discovery aspect of it? I think people meet, you know, each other on SciWorld much the same way as they do in real life. They don't necessarily go around asking everyone to be their friend, add me as a friend, as certain other social networks do. They really only look for people that are, you know, personally interesting to them or personally could be of use to them. And then they form a very tentative, as people do online, a very tentative sort of acquaintance at first that grows into perhaps a friendship later on. So this is, I think, relevant and different enough from other systems in that it is not social networking for social networking's sake. It is really networking for a personal reason of you know, discovering people that are interesting to you, discovering people that are of use to you in some ways.
So one of the questions is, many of the social network companies essentially failed because they did not have something beyond networking for the networking's sake. Mm-hmm. You don't go to a speed dating party just for the sake of speed dating. You hope that, you know, something else will come out of it, shall we say. How would that be, for instance, at OpenBC? What value propositions do you have for user beyond just the networking? We should actually add that the CEO of LinkedIn, Reid Hoffman, told me that OpenBC, in his perception, is the most successful networking company and growing faster than his own company, LinkedIn.
That is a very nice compliment, Andreas, and I really appreciate that you tell me that. I think on the midterm base, we need to add a lot of quality to the network. People really are looking to connect on their level or even on a higher level. So as OpenBC has grown into a million members already, we need to watch for quality, that we have on all levels enough people that are interesting. And a second aspect is that we need to foster offline meetings, because people are not virtual. People will always demand for physical meetings. That's why we are all together here. And I think we all enjoy this, because we can look at our eyes and we can really found long-term relationships. And it's just a complementary tool. We should not overestimate a social software networking tool. It's always linked to real life.
Rick and I are vigorously nodding here. My example is a company which is based in Singapore called Friday.com, Friday.com, which originally I sort of looked down upon as, this just seems to be a company which sort of organizes parties. But then I realized that they have, you know, I don't know how many tens of thousands of members, and I went to a party in Phuket 2 months ago where indeed there were 5,000 people showing up to the party. So the physical aspect does play a role there.
But still, the transaction costs, I mean, the one thing that's good on the web is the transaction costs are very low. That leads to exactly these kind of things, you know, people adding people just for the sake of it. That's for example, where Places comes in. The transaction costs in the real world are higher. So if I make the effort to go here, it means that I want to be here. And that, for example, if you throw something together, you know, like a social network like OpenBC in Places, you can see, you know, have these people actually been to conferences I also went to. The same, for example, goes for spam. You know, like with Places, it's you have to be at the place to talk about it, to describe it. You can only change and alter it if you're actually physically there. which makes spam almost impossible. Or I mean, you could decide to drive to all the Starbucks to put spam in there. But
that's great, yeah.
So I think all these blogs and photo blogs and vlogs and whatever, all these words that are coming out, and it's interesting that all of these concepts are really, fragmented. It's really hard to find a single space that has all of this, components in there. I think I draw a comparison to real life in that people really interact in a very complex way. They don't only interact with each other by sending them letters, exchanging letters. Sometimes they send each other photos. Sometimes nowadays, through broadband, you can send them videos. So, going forward, I think it's important that I know that, yes, I agree that these online communities are really an augmentation of real life, but it should keep up with the way people really interact in real life. Otherwise, it's only going to be a tool for the purpose of bringing more people to use the tool.
And in that case, it will not have a sustainable relationship, but die the death.
No.
Many of them.
So if you say this is about interactions and relations via the web, there has to be a fidelity in the relationship that expresses the quality of the relationship or the value, if you will, of any sort to myself. Mm-hmm. So if OpenBC, for example, manages to get that across, that I have a little dial from 1 to 10, and whenever I get a new invite or so, it already figured out for me what the value by my means of parameters is, that's going to be of immensely higher value to me, as these days the invitations get so many that you already start filtering again with means which probably don't do it justice.
I think we're starting to come across another sort of a challenge that companies and corporations in this area is going to have to deal with pretty soon, is that, like I said, real-life relationships are complex, and as such, online sort of augmentations of that is going to get more and more complex. I think the art of this and the challenge to everyone involved in this space is to make the experience sophisticated so that it mirrors real life effectively, but also makes it easy enough for the people to use comfortably, and so that the learning curve is not as high. Prohibitively high.
So let's actually have Brad, the next session is about to begin. Maybe let's have Brad have his last point and wrap it up.
I just wanted to say that I was struck by the ideas that we start off talking about discovery, and then we talked about interaction, and Felix mentioned transaction costs. It seems to me that it's all about, from our point of view, lowering the transaction costs for a wide variety of interactions. And the reason we want to do that is because the basis of what makes these interactions valuable is that people are constantly discovering things every moment of their life as they make choices. And they don't know that those discoveries are valuable to their social network if there's no cheap way to share them. And as we come up with a wide variety of cheap ways to share them, these social networks will flourish. That's what will make them flourish.
That's Yuri Engström's point of object-centered sociality. So actually you differentiate and express yourself through things like books, movies you see, etc. The web just supercharges the way we share it.
We're still
interesting in the same things, but we discover more people that actually have the same interests.
Right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Right. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you all.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.